We're going to discuss the alien reproduction vehicle. And a lot of people say, well, what are we talking about here? We'll get into great detail about all of this. We have some great guests, kind of really the gold standard when it comes to investigative reporting, in my opinion. We have Jim Mars on the line from Arlington, Texas. And we'll talk to Jim not only about what we're going to talk about here, but as far as the alien reproduction vehicles, but also he's got a new project, I understand. And, of course, this is the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination. And he, talking about gold standards, wrote the book on the best conspiracy investigative reporting, in my opinion. We have Grant Cameron lined up, and we on the line from Canada. And Grant is one of those guys that never gives up. He gets in there, keeps digging for the facts, and keeps coming up with new finds all the time. You'll always find Grant on the cutting edge of an investigation. If he's into it, he's into it 120%. Now, later on, I've invited Mark McCandish to be here. Now, Mark and Gordon Novell, who we're going to talk about a little bit here, is instrumental in investigating and trying to develop a company to come up with the funding, which is almost impossible, to find out exactly what powered these UFOs. And Mark was inside with this group. And he had some not necessarily great experiences, and he had some, but I think he'll add something to the conversation. And so I invited him to join us a little later. But right now, Jim Mars, how are you?
I'm fine, Jerry. Thank you for having me today. This is a very interesting topic, and one I think everybody needs to be aware of. You know, if I thought that the world is the way it is because that's the way it is and there wasn't any other way, then I still might not be happy with everything going on, but at least I could resign myself and be stoic and say, well, you know, we just have to put up with the energy and the technology we have because that's all we have. But I know, Gordon Novell knows, Grant Cameron knows, you know, thousands, perhaps millions others know, there are better ways of doing things, and the only reason it's not being done is because somewhere somebody doesn't want it done.
Before we even get into the subject and bring Grant into the conversation, you're almost through with a book, I understand. Can you talk about that? Can you tell us what it's about?
Well, actually, I've got one that just came out within the past month.
Well, okay, let's plug that one first.
And that one is... that one is my latest book, which is Our Occulted History. And I think y'all are going to love that one because it goes all the way back to the Big Bang and comes forward with the evidence to show that the development of the human species may have been kickstarted along the way by others, shall we say. Okay? And in fact, what this does is offer a third alternative to the conflict that's been going on between the Darwinist and the creationist, okay? It's a little bit of a combination of both with a little bit of something else thrown into the mix, and it's been doing quite well and was actually received better than I thought it was going to be because I thought it was kind of a far-out topic, but I do have lots of evidence for this. And then I think what you're talking about is I am putting the finishing touches on an updated version of my Kennedy assassination book, Crossfire, The Plot to Kill Kennedy. And this one, I think, is going to be well received, too, because I start off by putting in a question that I've been asked for years, which is, will we ever know the truth about what happened to John F. Kennedy? And my answer is yes. If you'll read my book, I'll be the first to admit we may not ever know all of the details, exactly who pulled the trigger, exactly who paid the money, exactly where they moved to. But in general, you can know the truth of what happened. It's there. It's obvious. It's in our face. And you will learn that by reading my new updated version of Crossfire.
When do you expect that to be out on the market?
I'm not certain. It's coming out from Basic Books, imprint of Perseus Books, and I think they're talking about, well, I know they want to have it out before the November 50th anniversary of the assassination, so I'm thinking they're trying to get it out by, say, the end of September, 1st of October.
Okay, and we'll be talking more about that as we go along. Grant Cameron, yeah. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. I'm kind of honored to be on the show with your guests here, because these are guys that I've sort of, when I go through my research, I've watched these guys and read their stuff, and then to be on a show with them, it's kind of an honor for me. So I'm glad to be here.
Well, Grant, you've earned your way here. Jim, I think he's one of the top new guys on the block, and we say new guys. Grant's been doing this for decades.
Right. Well, I was getting ready to say I don't think he's a Johnny Come Lately. I don't know if he's been at it as long as I have. because mine, I go back 40, almost 50 years. But he's certainly put in his time.
Yeah, 37 years.
There you go. We're pretty close.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting the way some of these topics tweak our interest, and we suddenly get to be known for certain things.
Yeah.
Some of these things, and Jim, you kind of alluded to it with this book about evolution and maybe not evolution, maybe we were planted here or whatever. What's the name of that book, by the way? The one that's out now.
Our Occulted History. And let me quickly point out that when I use the word occulted, this book is not about zombies or werewolves or witches or anything we normally think of as the occult. I'm using it in the astronomical sense. When the moon eclipses the sun, that's called an occultation. It occults the sun, which simply means it hides or masks the sun. So our cultured history is about the history that's been hidden from us when we go through the school system.
And I've never really talked to you, Grant, about it, but how do you feel about this subject that Jim's talking about? I've always kind of taken it for granted that it wasn't exactly evolution all the way, but it wasn't exactly creationism either.
I've sort of gotten into that myself. I mean, in the I sort of look at the scientific tie-ins with consciousness. I'm doing that whole thing now and sort of get into the idea that a lot of the stuff, when you look at science, is actually belief systems like religion, that they basically have these belief systems, and you sort of assume that they're right, they're smart, and then when you start looking at it, you realize that they're as far off as anybody, and that a lot of this stuff we just take for granted, like I call it the Powerball theory of evolution, this sort of, you know, that a lot of this stuff is just sort of made up, like the crash test dummies of the Roswell thing, that some of it's pretty stupid when you look at it. And I think we have to redo the whole thing and start to look at what's real, what's not real in terms of evolution and creationism and that sort of stuff, that it's a very deep field. And to me, it ties into UFOs.
You know, Jim and Grant, go ahead, Jim. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, he's absolutely correct. They've done study after study, and when you talk about the scientific evidence, one of the things I'll point out in my new book, Our Occulted History, is how that science has been suppressed. There are tantalizing evidence, sacred sites, artifacts, all over the world, all the way down through history, that point to a very different history than what we've been taught in school, and yet this gets sequestered away. For example, one of the examples I use is the Egyptian artifacts found in the Grand Canyon back about 1909, and they were snapped up by the Smithsonian Institution and hidden away, and every time I think about that, I think about the scene from Indiana Jones where they take the Ark of the Covenant and put it back in a warehouse somewhere, right? Yeah. But apparently this is exactly what's going on. And a lot of people don't realize that the Smithsonian Institute is an agency of the United States government. So whoever controls the United States government controls our history, and to a large extent through grants and through foundations. They control not only the government, but the education process in our universities. And I know from talking to people in the fields of anthropology and archaeology that if you try to go in certain areas, you are at best discouraged. And at worst, they throw you out of the department if you try to talk about things that they don't want to hear about.
Now, when we let's get to the subject at hand, and this is, I want to see if I am on the right track with you guys. I kind of feel in the last half of the 20th century, say from Roswell forward, there was a deeply secret group that was formed here in the United States, and they did some reverse engineering on extraterrestrial spacecraft, and I feel after 47 years, 50 years, now it's 70 years almost. Maybe it is 70. I don't have my calendar in front of me, but it's getting pretty damn close. And how many people have died testing this stuff? We don't know that either. There may be 100 pilots or more that have died over this. And then the billions of dollars that have been spent, and what do we got to show for it? A bunch of toys where some people put it away and will never release it to us. I mean, that's what it appears to me that's happening. Do you guys agree with me on that, or is there something else I'm missing?
No, I this is Jim Mars. I definitely agree with you. In fact, this is nothing new, and we're seeing the use of exotic technology today that is generally not known to the public, and it goes way back. Let me quote you something that was said to the Senate Democratic Caucus on January the 7th, 1958, by future President Lyndon B. Johnson, who at that time was a senior and very powerful senator. And here's his quote. He says, "Control of space means control of the world. From space, the masters of infinity would have the power to control the Earth's weather, to cause drought and flood, to change the tides and raise the levels of the sea, to divert the Gulf Stream and change the climate to frigid." And there is something more powerful than the ultimate weapon. That is the ultimate position, the position of total control over the Earth that lies somewhere in outer space. So they knew it then, and they know it now, and they're working to gain that control. But we don't get to hear about it. We're just expected to watch TV and pay our taxes to support their efforts.
Yeah, Grant, you've been releasing some things on your website that have been pretty interesting about this whole subject. And evidently, in one of your postings, you talk about 2003 being a year of the United States Central Intelligence Agency, along with many other, I guess, sitting U.S. presidents, largely were denied at that time in 2003. They didn't know much about this. Did I misread that, or do you still stand by that?
I'm not sure which article you're referring to. I mean, it's kind of a thing like Jim's talking about. We're here to pay the taxes and to just sort of be the sheeple and do what we're told to do. Even the secret is a secret. That's why it's so hard to get at this, and why I'm so interested in anything that has to do with the CIA or the White House to try to get some indication of exactly who's controlling the secret. Because my experience was that I had a number of very close sightings, so I knew there was something to this. I knew it was probably extraterrestrial, and I just have been spending my whole career trying to figure out who knows where the bodies are buried, who it controls this whole thing. And it comes down to even the secret is a secret. Like, even the fact that they have a secret is something that they want the rest of the world to think this is all nonsense, because you're basically trying to put it together for military purposes. And if you give up the secret, then the Chinese and the Russians and whoever else all say, well, you know, you mean this is for real? And then they start working on it. So you want it in this sort of a quagmire darkness that nobody can figure it out. So it's very, very hard to figure out who is involved. And that's why I got interested in the Novell thing, because Novell was making these claims that he had this backing from the CIA and from the White House and stuff like that. And that was sort of my interest, was trying to go up into those agencies and try to figure out who knew where the bodies were buried. And that's why I became so interested in Gordon Novell.
Hey, Grant. In other words, and I've always said this for a long time, the one rule of the game is don't give away the game.
Yeah.
And by the way, we're not keeping anything from the Russians or the Chinese. Do you think they don't know about all this?
Well, sure,
they're actively involved in looking at it, too. The secrecy is to keep the American public in the dark. And let me tell you why. I don't think the rulers, and when I say the rulers of the United States, I'm not necessarily talking about the politicians who take their orders. I'm talking about the people behind the scenes that actually call the shots.
Yeah.
I don't think they care if we know that there's aliens out there somewhere, okay? What they care about is that if we know, if the public knew beyond any question of a doubt that there's aliens out there, then they also know that there's alternative technology out there which endangers these folks' monopolies over energy and medicine and communication and transportation.
Sure, it's all about the money. Yeah.
Yeah,
and
all the money.
Yeah.
Well, you know, both of you, Grant and Jim, there was a document out there at one time called Supreme Cosmic Secret. Well, you got to add this the secret group, the MJ-12 or whoever they are. They're pretty blatant about telling you things. They just don't explain them, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of, you can't really, I guess best secrets are hidden in public, maybe.
That's true, because then if somebody pops something open, they can always say, well, shoot, that's not a secret. That was in the National Enquirer.
Yeah. I've said this for a number of years. I think there is a program to disclose the basic story, what's called the core story. And that they want it out there, but the classified aspects of exactly the technology and the mind control and all this kind of stuff that they're working on, that's the kind of stuff they protect. But they're not really too worried about you and I and Jim sort of talking about this, because there may become a day when this thing sort of unravels, and then they don't want people being way back in 1947. They want you sort of a position, like Jim says, where they can say, well, you know, this has always been... out there. Even John Alexander talks about that. He says, you know, that disclosure is there, that it's out there, which isn't really true. But that's sort of the idea, is that, you know, it's not that big a deal if it does sort of get out of control.
Yeah, I was blown away one time doing an interview with John Alexander, and because it was on, I was doing a documentary on the MJ-12, and I actually had him as a counterbalance, because he was arguing there was no such thing is MJ-12, a group that was in control of the UFO issue. And right there on camera, he says, no, I don't believe there was an MJ-12. He said, but now UFOs, those are real. And I said, whoa. But now, let me say, what do you guys think about this? I think we're in a reverse conditioning process, and here's why. Polls, national polls in the 1950s, showed that virtually no one believed there was any life outside of the Earth. Well, today, the national polls show quite the opposite. The vast majority of people, 80, 85%, now say they do believe that there's life outside of the Earth. That's quite a turnaround in about 50 years, 60 years. But see, they need that because if you listen to what has been quoted to Wernher von Braun, he said back in the 70s that at that time, the big common enemy was international communism. He said, when that doesn't work anymore, and of course communism collapsed in 89, he said it's going to be terrorists probably from the Middle East. Well, here we are. And then he said, when that no longer works as a unifying defense factor, he said it's going to be a threat from space. And of course, we've already seen Ronald Reagan get up in front of the United Nations and say, what if there was a threat from space and we have to band all the nations together to fight for the common good, you know? So how can they make a threat from space seem credible if nobody believes there's any life out there? So we've been in a conditioning process to, as Grant said, understand the core story that, yes, they are out there. So that in one of these days, in the not too distant future, I think they're gonna say, "Oops, they are out there," you know, and they want to eat you. So, you know, band together and take, you know, fall into this new world order, so that we can defend the Earth against these terrorists from outer space. And unfortunately, a large percentage of the public will fall for it.
Yeah, and it has worked fairly well in terms of, you were talking about this thing about creationism and evolution. I tell a story when I lecture about Dr. Victor Stenger, who is one of the sort of the high priests of the new atheist movement. And he was in an interview one time. He was sort of very upset about what he calls the random theory of evolution that is taught in schools, and yet basically scientists basically say, well, it doesn't threaten the concept of God, that we can teach evolution, but it doesn't affect the threat of God. And he said, this is ridiculous, this is absolutely insane, I'm going to write a book. And he's very upset about this whole thing. And then he said, you know, only 16% of people we teach it in school, and only 16% of people in America believe this random theory of evolution, that there is no God and it was all evolution. And I'm thinking, as soon as you said that, I thought, well, man, and you followed, you were doing pretty good. You know, we got 70-80% of people believe there's stuff in outer space. We got 40% of people believe that UFOs are real. We believe that, you know, 70% of people believe the government is covering up. And I'm thinking, well, you know, we're actually doing pretty good here compared to people who have actually their theory being taught at school.
So in other words, more people believe in UFOs than they believe in evolution, but one's being taught in schools and the other is not.
Exactly. So the program is working.
Well, you know what? In researching for our occulted history, I went back and was reading and studying through Charles Darwin. Darwin himself, see, a lot has been attributed to him. That he himself didn't really say, like he never did specifically say that we are descended from apes. That was something that was just attributed to him and his work. But what he did say was, if you cannot prove an uninterrupted fossil line, you know, leading from the earliest up to us, then my theory doesn't work. Well, they haven't been able to prove an unbroken line. There's breaks all through it, so his theory doesn't work. And yet, that's what we're being taught as scientific gospel.
Exactly.
Let's get back to back engineering, and I want to talk a little bit about Ram Gravionics LLC. And I know Jim Mars, you and I've visited with Gordon a lot, and you even actually worked with him on the thing. You created this briefing paper along with Rich Dolan, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, and when I tell our listeners exactly the background behind that, what we're talking about here.
Let me see if I can do that in a concise manner. It's not real easy because it stretches out over a period of years. But there was a time when Gordon had some time to himself. I think the reality is he was serving some time. And he read. He read extensively. And he looked at all kinds of things, particularly scientific papers, and then blended those, the science we know about, with the science that people like Grant Cameron talk about, their personal experiences, and then whistleblowers within the military, within the government. And he came to realize that the government had possession of what he called ARVs, alien reproduction vehicles, okay? In other words, flying saucers or, you know, craft that was not ours, and that they had been duplicating it and reproducing these and trying to make them work. I think the famous case of the giant globe spewing radiation down near Houston was one of these efforts, surrounded by helicopters. This was a case, apparently, of where we had tried to use alien technology and was trying to figure out how to make it work. There's also a lot of films and a lot of testimony from, of course, Area 51 about things flying out of there that were doing impossible-seeming maneuvers. So he knew they had this, and so he began to work at that and came up with what he called a circuit, which he said would create a vortex energy field, and which is the propulsion system. Not long back, I saw a science fiction movie about a future trip to Mars, and they had their jet engines, and they were cutting them on, and they were cutting them off, and they were blasting dust off the Martian surface as they tried to slow their descent and land. That is old technology, folks. No, the UFOs travel in energy fields. And this is, and within the energy field, gravity is nullified. Also, what we're finding out is that gravity and time are interconnected. Throughout the UFO literature, we find that when the UFO comes over, car engines stop. And then when the UFO flies on, the car engines start again. But nowhere does anybody say, oh, and I turned the key on and started the car again. when the field comes over and the car is within this energy field, time is frozen. The pistons freeze. Everything just stops. And this also accounts for the issue of missing time in the UFO field. Somebody says, well, I encountered this UFO on my way home from work about 6 o'clock, and then I didn't get home till 7, but I only lived 10 minutes away from my sighting, you know? Well, that's because when they were in the energy field, time had stopped for them. And that seems to be the case, and Gordon pretty well figured all this out and decided he had the secret for devising a circuit that could create one of these gravity-nullifying energy fields. The problem was, he was one guy. He didn't have any money. So he went and started trying to put together a coalition of both scientists and production people, engineers, and he did. He put quite a team together, but nowhere did they quite have the money that it would take to go into production with something like this. I know he started at one point with a fella to build a prototype, but I'm not sure that that ever came to fruition, and there was a number of stumbling blocks thrown in his way. So that seems to be the story, and he set up this company, RAM, and that was Reproduction Alien Vehicle, replicated ARV machine, actually is what it stands for, RAM. And because he was going to duplicate the alien reproduction machine or vehicle that he had reason to believe was in the possession of the United States government. I know he even wrote letters to Henry Kissinger. He wrote letters to Zbigniew Brzezinski. He wrote letters to the Rockefellers. And he basically, his argument was, we know this technology exists, and we know that you know that this technology exists, and it needs to be released to the world so that all of humanity can benefit from all of this. And needless to say, he got no replies from anybody.
How much do you think we've spent trying to back engineer something like this? $100 billion? Is that unreasonable? Or is it much more than that?
Well, not only that, you have to count in all the money that we've wasted throwing at NASA for big old rockets and studies of stuff, space shots that were unnecessary and actually obsolete in view of this type of technology. But as Grant said, it's all about the money. And so they don't want to interrupt the money flow. So, we see this all over. We see this in medicine, for example. There can be a simple cure for some disease, cancer, for example. There are cures for cancer, but they're not being released because there's more people making a living off of cancer than dying from it.
Yeah, just recently down in Houston, the medical board withdrew their lawsuit against a doctor who says he has a cancer cure and has had it for 15 years.
Yeah.
And the FDA was behind trying to kick him out of the medical profession.
Well, FDA and the USDA, I mean, they're now sending armored troops against farmers who are trying to sell fresh milk. I mean, where in the heck are we? Where are we? You know, somebody's controlling this country that obviously does not have the best interests of the public in mind.
When we talk about that's the problem I find, Jim and Grant, with this whole thing. I just have trouble wrapping my arms around it because it's such an egregious thing they're doing. Just think of what a great society we would have, to choose words that Lyndon Johnson used. But the point is, we would, if we didn't have to pay for exorbitant petroleum and other costs, energy costs. Look at how much it costs now just to cool your house.
Well, wait a minute. Have you thought about this? When I was a kid, I worked in a grocery store in Kroger for Kroger's groceries. And if somebody had come in and said, do you carry bottled water? I would have laughed at them because, hey, you
know,
bottled water, are you kidding me? Water comes out of the garden hose, right?
Right.
But today, whole shelves, whole aisles are filled with bottled water, and it's all being controlled by one of a handful of corporations, primarily Coca-Cola and Perrier. And they're getting control over the whole world's water supply, And if you look at it, you know, the way it's bottled and sold, a gallon of water costs more than a gallon of gasoline.
Yeah, it's not cheap anymore.
Not cheap anymore.
And now, thanks
to Monsanto, they're trying to get control over the food supply.
Yeah. How do either of you, or can you explain? I can't explain it, but people seem to just accept the fact that the water utilities aren't any good. No longer is the water safe. They got to go buy bottled water, and then they continue along. Whether or not they have to buy bottled water or not, we don't know.
Well, I'm going to let Grant answer that one because I've been out here on my own well for 30 years. I don't buy bottled water, and I don't have to worry about fluoride.
Yeah, I think people are basically conditioned the same as with ufology. You figure, like, why don't people stand up and sort of fight back about, you know, free what appears to be free energy or all this sort of stuff? Is that people are so busy in their daily lives just taking their kids to soccer and going to work and stuff like that and, you know, watching TV that they basically haven't got time to take up any issues. They're just basically in survival mode. And there's only a couple of people who are actually sort of thinking about the whole thing, and it's very easy to direct people down whatever road you want to direct them down.
That's true, and Grant, you're getting into my boogaboo right now because of journalism and the news media. This is where I come from, and that's why people, I don't think they're truly apathetic. They're just tied up, like you say, trying to live a life, take care of their family and their work. That's why they turn on the TV. That's why they listen to radio, to find out from the journalist what's going on, and they're being shortchanged because there is no journalism anymore, only corporate advertising systems.
Yeah,
I agree about you on that a whole lot. I mean, it's just a PR machine.
Yeah, because can I bring up a story, Jerry? Because this is a significant thing when we're talking about back engineering, and it was an interview you did, which I think was one of the best interviews in ufology in terms of back engineering, because, again, we go back to John Alexander, who says, you know, the government doesn't care, there's no back engineering, and when you come right down to it, it's pretty hard to sort of, you know, prove or, you know, show what factory's doing it and produce the documents and this sort of stuff. But there was one interview that you did, and this was with Ron Blackburn. Do you remember the interview 2005
at the Cross Officer?
And Ron Blackburn is significant because when John Alexander started his group, this Advanced Physics Theoretical Project, which people knew as the UFO Working Group, I got a hold of documents from this group, and I made this public in about 2005 that it wasn't the UFO Working Group, it was this Advanced Physics Group. And then John, when he came out his book, said, yeah, it was called the Advanced Physics Group, and the reason we called it that was so people couldn't FOIA it. And one of the people that he had brought on to this group, he called all these people, these top secret special access people, into this group. One of them was Ron Blackburn. And when you interviewed him in 2005, you said to him, you know, well, what about back engineering? You're rumored to be the guy who's back engineering this stuff. And you know how Ron went, well, you know, there's one thing I can talk about. And he talked about this, and it has never, to me, it's one of the most significant things that's ever been said. And it really hasn't gone anywhere. And that was where he said to you, he said, well, actually, he's got the patent developed for stopping sonic booms on aircraft up to Mach 3 or 4. And where he got the technology was by watching a couple hundred UFO films. And he's with the Air Force Special Lab or whatever it is there, Weapons Lab. And he said he developed this technology where they sent out this beam of microwave energy to stop the sonic booms, and that this is what they use on jet aircraft, and it was developed from UFO technology by Ron Blackburn. And he basically says to you on video and says, yes, this is how it was developed. And then he also stated to you that he had developed a cloaking, that the UFOs were able to cloak themselves, and that he had developed a technology that the UFOs were using to cloak themselves. And this is out in the open. I mean, this is not something you got to really, you know, dig and find. It's on video. It's still on the internet between you and him where he's doing this interview, and you see this whole thing where it's out in the open and still nobody pays attention to it. And then he talks about, remember at the end of the interview where he talks about the fact, he talks to this guy at Loveless Clinic in Albuquerque where the bodies are supposedly kept at a point. And he talks to this guy who's dealt with the bodies and this sort of stuff. And as he's leaving the room, he talks about this thing. He says, oh, I hear, he throws this guy a bone. He says, well, I hear that the president and Congress may come up with a rule that will exempt everybody who has technology advice or, you know, classified UFO technology. And the guy says to Ron, as he's saying, it's going to require a lot more than an order from the president to get this stuff out. And so I thought that was a significant interview that is out there, which basically says John Alexander is absolutely wrong, that one of John Alexander's people that he invited to his group is openly stating that technology that's used on jet aircraft today came from watching a couple hundred UFO films. Where he got the UFO films is another question, but it's out there in the open. There's no question about what Ron Blackburn said.
Ron Blackburn was just sitting there in the audience at a show we were doing in Las Vegas, and Bill Hamilton came up to me, and he's during a break, and he said, you need to get Blackburn on. He knows a lot more than you think he does. And that's how that interview came about. And as you know, Grant, I tried to get a hold of him later. He's kind of gone. I can't find him.
Yeah. Well, maybe after your interview, they made him quieten down. Because he was pretty open in that interview. I mean,
he was.
He wasn't beating around the bush. He basically said
he was willing to talk. And I kicked myself many times. I appreciate what you said about the interview. But there were a lot of things I could have nailed him down on. I should have. But I was actually, like you, flabbergasted about what this guy was saying and his background and how he came to me represented. He obviously wasn't a flake, you know.
Yeah.
And I did check into him, but later before we played the interview, and he did have a military background and came highly recommended.
Yeah, and was on John Alexander's group, this UFO working group. He was one of the people on that group.
Right. Jim, I know you run across that in journalism over the years. You find a good source like that, and you let them go, or they get away somehow.
Well, it's all out there for anybody that really wants to study it. The thing is, though, see, this is why, you know, when's the last time you guys ever, remember hearing a national politician refer to the Republic? They don't even call it the Republic anymore. Now all they can talk about is democracy, democracy. Got to defend democracy. Well, what's democracy? The most classic example of democracy in action is a lynch mob, right? Majority rules. Okay, well, that's not what we had. It's not what we want. That's not what we were given by the founder fathers. We were given a democratic republic. Okay, now the thing is, under a democracy, under a democratic republic, you have to adhere to the law. There's laws, and there's a constitution, a bill of rights, and you have to adhere to that. Under democracy, it's mob rule. Whatever the majority says, go. And if you want to elect a president who's not even eligible under the constitution, you can do it because majority rules. And that's why all they can talk about is democracy, democracy, and that's how they keep this stuff down. You guys know about this alien technology. I know about it. I probably thousands know about it. But this is a nation of 350 million people. They watch TV. They don't know about it because it's democracy in action. The mass media controls majority. Majority dictates what we're going to believe in.
Yeah. When we talk about Ram Gravionics and Gordon Novell, let's get back to a basic question, and both of you can answer this. Both of you have met him, right?
Yeah.
Was Gordon for real? That's the question. I've known Gordon for a long time.
It depends. For me, it depends on what you mean by real. You know?
Yeah.
A real person. I think he really cared. I mean, I've had late night talks with him, you know, and I think he truly cared about what happened to the human race.
I agree with you there.
Can I ask Jim? Because Jim knew, I didn't know him. The only reason I got involved with him was because of this incident in 1988. That involved Frank Carlucci, who was the Secretary of Defense for Reagan. I was interested in that whole thing. And he was National Security Advisor, where they test flew this object at Norton Air Force Base, which you're going to talk about later. But I'd like to ask a question, because my interest was this POTUS briefing that we were talking about, where he puts this thing out and he wants this sort of a movie script done. He's trying to promote it to Steven Spielberg. And in this one interview he does with Alan Steinfeld, he talks about the fact that he has backing from the CIA, and that would be my question. Did he have Ronald Pandolfi's backing from the CIA? Because people would say, no, he didn't, and my experience was I knew Bob Emeniger very well, And Bob Emenigre, as you know, was responsible for this documentary in the 1970s. It was authorized by the Pentagon to do this UFO documentary.
Yeah.
And that's all he was really interested in. He really wasn't interested in UFOs. And so one time, this is about 2 years ago, I'm talking to him, and I said to him, I said, well, he brings up the fact that he had a phone call from Ronald Pendolfi, who is the top scientist at CIA, and he's been rumored to be the UFO guy in the CIA. And I said, well, why would you be talking to Ronald Pendolfi? You haven't been involved in UFOs. Why would he phone you? And he said, well, it had to do with Gordon Novell. And he said Gordon Novell had this thing, and they had the diagrams, and he wanted him to do some PR promotion for the RAM program and whatever. And Bob said he wasn't really that interested. He didn't really believe it was for real or whatever, but he was willing to help out. And then Gordon told him, he said, well, in order for you to get on, you have to be vetted by Ronald Pendolfi. And Emenigre told me, yeah, Pendolfi actually did phone him. And I said, well, what did he ask? He said, oh, he just asked me a bunch of personal questions and whatever. And then Gordon Novell phones him back and says, well, Pendolfi says you're a go. You can be on the project. So that's my question is not so much, it doesn't really matter to me what was in the thing, whether it was for real or whether it was accurate or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The thing was that Gordon Novell was running around with this post-briefing thing that on the front he said it had the White House symbol, it had the CIA symbol, and it had Ronald Pendolfi's name on it, and he said he had their backing to run around the country with this thing and try to promote this thing. So my interest is, if he's being backed by the CIA, if he's being, he said 5 years, I think it was, that Pendolfi backed him and then sort of cut him loose, that if they're backing him, then it doesn't really matter about Ronald Pendolfi. It's who's backing Ronald Pendolfi. They're taking him serious. They're trying to promote this thing for whatever reason. That's mm-hmm. my question. Did he have any sort of official backing from the White House or from the CIA?
Okay. Official backing, I don't know. What I can tell you for absolute sure, though, is that he was in fairly constant communication with Ron Pendolfi, who is who he says he is. We all know that he's legitimate and connected to science, technology, and the CIA. I know when I first heard all that, I had the same question you have, Grant. And so I told Gordon, I said, I want to talk to Ron Pendolfi. Well, I did on several occasions. Plus, I had access to email correspondence. And yes, that was an ongoing thing. Now, was it official? I don't know. And in fact, I kind of doubt it, because I'm the one who tried to tell Gordon early on. I said, I think he kept trying. I was with him on occasions when he'd tell people, I have the support of the CIA. Well, he was in touch with the CIA through Ron Pendolfi and others. And I think he may, in his own mind, have truly believed that he had some kind of official support from him. He seemed to believe that. But I told him and warned him, I said, I think this is a vacuum cleaner operation. I think they're just keeping tabs on you, and they want to know what you know, to find out if you're getting into any secret matters and stuff.
Exactly.
And
it,
that seems now to be proven true, because I know towards the end of his life there, he even finally admitted to me that he thought that Pendolfi had kind of turned on him and was not fulfilling promises or things he had said to work on Gordon's behalf. And now, after he's dead, I notice Pendolfi's backing off even further and claiming he's a fraud and yada yada, which is kind of typical CIA methodology. But I guarantee you, for a long, ongoing period of time, Gordon was in constant touch with Ron Pendolfi and was being, shall we say, guided by him. But now, if this was I'm sure Pendolfi would argue that this was not any kind of official connection with the CIA, and that may be true.
Yeah, the CIA is not involved in UFOs, are they?
they would never admit it if they were.
Yeah, I had heard that too from various people in the scientific community, that they were afraid of Pendolfi, because if you're working in the scientific field and you're into UFOs, you always got to watch where you step across that line.
That's
where,
right,
you start to touch the classified stuff, and that's the end of your career. You
that's
can,
right,
you know, you all your contracts are gone, and Pendolfi can call you up, or, you know, I think that's part of his job, is to watch the community to see if there's any classified information moving across the line, and those people get stepped on.
Right. And I know that Gordon certainly was of the opinion that he had the secret, okay? Now, you know, you would think that this is what kind of convinces me that they do know it at some level at some point. Because you would think that somebody would go, well, he seems to know what he's talking about. Let's at least try this, or let's build a prototype. And yet, not only did they not do that, but it seemed like they were always throwing stumbling blocks in his way to prevent him from doing that, to include physical threats on his life.
That's true. About Pandolfi, when Gordon passed away, I contacted Ron, and he responded and sent me an email, which I read on this program, when we did a salute to Gordon passing away, a tribute. And I don't think he would have done that, reading between the lines about what he said about Gordon, about basically it was a lot of CIA double talk about right. meeting in a place where kind of a safe zone in a restaurant out of the way. And both of them stepped back into the night to do what they needed to do. And I'm paraphrasing, of course. But the point is, in Pandolfi and his world of the CIA, it seemed to me that that was pretty much a straightforward tribute to a fellow traveler.
Well, let me put it this way, and we'll put you in on this, Jerry. What if you were contacted by somebody who was a fairly ranking CIA official, told you to meet in a public place, you know, in a dark corner, and you sit there and discuss very, very secretive and esoteric type subjects, and he kept telling you what a good job you're doing and blah, 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 and then you went away, would you consider that you were working for the CIA?
Technically, I wouldn't be.
Probably. Probably.
Yeah, Gordon, I've often thought that Gordon was being taken advantage of by the CIA.
Yes, I think they were just keeping tabs on him. And see, let me tell you something. This goes all the way back. He's been accused of all kinds of things, including being the umbrella man in the Dealey Plaza in the Kennedy assassination, and that he was working for the CIA, blah, blah, blah. He did work for a double-check firm that apparently was connected to the CIA. And yet, I would continually try to pin him down. Did you ever work for the CIA? And he consistently said no. And I think then the reality is he worked with people with the CIA for years. But was he ever a hired employee? No.
Yeah, that's the same story that Bill Moore told back. You give that example about if you were contacted, and that's what Bill Moore said. I mean, he was contacted by a high level guy inside the CIA, and he went and he took the guy's credentials and the scientific guy that contacted him. They went to the head of news for CBS in Los Angeles, had him vet the credentials of these guys, and Bill Moore had basically said if any researcher worth his salt, if he had been approached like I had by high-ranking government people offering to help and do all this kind of stuff, anybody would take that opportunity to jump in there. And yeah. So that's why it's so significant to me with Ronald Pandolfi, because a lot of people will say that Ronald Pandolfi, he had this incident in 96 where with the Chinese situation where it got called up in front of Congress. And some people have said after that, his elevator really didn't go to the top floor anymore. And I disagree. I think this is a very high-level guy. He was moved up in about 2008, 2009 to the National Intelligence Office, which is above the CIA, works directly for the president. You, if you're not really with it, and you're not going to get elevated. So he was at the top pinnacle of the intelligence world, just outside the White House. And to have this guy involved, with Novell indicates that, you know, there is interest there, and I'm always interested because before him, it's a whole chain of people. It's Ronald Pandolfi from 83 on. Before that, it was Kit Green. Before that, it was Arthur Lundahl. There's a whole group of these high-level CIA people who have interacted with the UFO community since at least 1954.
And they interacted with Gordon Novell.
Yes. And I think that's significant. That's what my interest in the Gordon Novell thing. And a lot of people say, well, Gordon Novell was this, Gordon Novell was that. It's irrelevant what Gordon Novell was. It was, if these people are dealing with them, then there's something to be looking at instead of that's trying right. to, because a lot of people, when this POTUS thing came out, said, oh, this is a hoax government document. I'm going like, where did you get government document? Nobody, Gordon, I didn't say, nobody said it was a government document. Everybody just basically said it was something that had been written, and I mentioned that you had helped write this thing, and Dolan had written this thing. It wasn't a government document. It was just something that Gordon was in charge of. Gordon was trying to get this thing promoted, and it sort of turned into this sort of conspiracy of, you know, this hoax government document, and but I think with these high-level government people being involved, and I heard lots of names associated with the RAM thing that, you know, high-level people that Gordon had interested people in this program that he was working on.
Well, I'm looking at the cover here, and let's just read it. It says, prepared for the Central Intelligence Agency. Prepared for, not prepared from or by.
Yeah.
Okay, POTUS briefing. And then it's got a seal that says Officer Director of the National Intelligence. All right, well, he put Ron Pandolfi's office seal on there. Eyes only, classification Umbra 32, whatever the heck that means. I think that was Gordon's. I don't know if it's a real designation or Gordon's. And then it says U.S. Government Liaison Control Officer, Dr. Ronald Pandolfi, and Production Control Executive, Gordon Novell. And then it lists an executive producer who was a guy who told him he could get a movie deal going. And that's all it is. Why would anybody think that's a government document?
Yeah, exactly.
It kind of looks like one, but then again, that was Gordon's idea. If you are going to present, say, to the Defense Department a plan for, say, a new jet fighter or whatever, are you going to write it out on a yellow pad? No, you're going to type something up, and you're going to have little classification stuff on it. You're going to make it look real government-ese and
sure.
You know, bureaucrat-ese and have all the stuff. That was his idea. I didn't necessarily agree with that. If you're going to say something, just say it, but he had been at it a long time, and he wanted to present the thing as if it was a very official type presentation. And so, okay, doesn't mean it's a government document.
Well,
yeah.
one of the reasons we're even talking about this tonight, if we go back to the man Gordon Novell, is he had lots of stories over the years. And you could verify some of them. Some of them had a little bit of truth in them. It was hard to tell exactly what was happening. And I think, A, he probably did that on purpose.
Yeah.
And B, he was a kind of guy who liked to be the center of attention.
Yeah.
And Jim, you can't take this away from Gordon Novell. Nobody can. He did have an ethic about wanting this free energy to be developed.
I think he was really, really serious about that. You also have to understand that he, although had technical training, was an electronics expert years ago, but then electronics changes every few months, so I don't know how up he was on everything, but he did have a reputation for being an electronics expert, but he never claimed to be a scientist, he never claimed to be a journalist, he never claimed to be a politician. Okay, he was an entrepreneur. He got his start as a young man in New Orleans by creating and setting up a World's Fair or something like that. He was quite proud of that, and he was hustling and trying to do projects ever since. Okay, so being an entrepreneur is not necessarily a bad thing, but to be an entrepreneur, you got to wheel and deal, and you got to deal in the business world. Worse yet, you got to deal in the government world. And in those worlds, you don't go in with your hat in your hand and go, well, I'm not been very successful, but I was hoping you'd look at my latest project. No, man, you go in, you know, tie on, chest out. Hey, I've got something you need, you know.
Right.
You do the super salesman job on them. And that's what he was doing. And once you understand that, I don't see what the problem is.
And of course, some of the paradoxes about Gordon Novell is, you know, he kind of never really shut down the JFK assassination relationship. In other words, he let people believe he might be the umbrella man, even though he denied it. But he was kind of a wink and a grin, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. And Gordon, I believe I'm right about this, Grant, didn't he tell you at one time he shot a gun at Kennedy or something?
No, I didn't tell me that, no.
No, he didn't.
Okay. No, that does not sound like him. I don't think he
Okay, some a third party was telling me that.
Yeah, there's lots of stories about him, but
well, that's
I know.
I yield to
no one when it comes to knowledge of the Kennedy assassination, and I leaned on him numerous times, and he consistently said he was in Two Shores in New York and not in Dealey Plaza.
Yeah.
And guys, I'll say this. To me, the proof that he was not directly connected to the Kennedy assassination is the sheer fact that he lived so long. If he had been involved, believe me, he wouldn't have been around in the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s.
Well, I hope, like Jim, I hope maybe you can do some sort of book on him or something, because it's kind of bad the way he's sort of going down in flames here after he died. That because I know, like John Lear, I know John Lear fairly well. They're doing a movie on his life. He had a kind of a life like Novell. I think it'd be interesting to have someone sort of who knew him fairly well to write up his story, because he had a lot of interesting stories. So he was an interesting guy.
Yeah, that's absolutely for true. And the thing is, you could almost tell the underground history of the 20th century through Gordon Novell's eyes, because he was, Jim Garrison did try to extradite him from to New Orleans for the Clay Shaw trial and tried to tie him into the Kennedy assassination. And then in Watergate, of course, he was approached and was tried to get him to build a degaussing gun that would erase the 18-minute tape, and then he was mixed up with the John DeLorean, and then he also was in with Ramsey Clark's investigation of the Waco debacle, and yeah, so you can almost track all of the great conspiracies of the 20th century somehow tangentially involve Gordon Novell.
Yeah,
you got a good point about that. I want to talk a little bit about the idea of making a movie to reveal this.
Okay, let me quickly say this. I don't know how our time's running. I think we're about to run out here, but let me just say this. After trying to contact the, I don't know, whatever you want to call them, the movers, shakers, the New World Order, Henry Kissinger, Brzezinski, he tried to write to President Obama, trying to go to these people and say, we know, this technology, we need to get it out to the public, and he was getting nowhere. Then his next thought was, if he could produce a major grade A Hollywood blockbuster, it would bring the issue to the public and possibly force their hand into releasing some of this technology. That's why it was only after he failed to make any impact on the secret holders that he decided to go the Hollywood route.
Yeah.
Jim, we're going to hang around here and talk a little bit about it. You're welcome to hang on, too, as well.
I can hang on for a little while.
Okay, fine. I'm going to take a break, and we're going to bring in Mark McCandish here in a minute, who actually was part of the Secret RAM Group, an aerospace designer, did a lot of things along that line. Maybe get a picture of exactly what they were trying to develop. And there's lots of other things we need to cover as well. And Grant, I hope you can hang in too.
Yeah.
Okay. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back, and we'll bring in Mark and continue talking with Grant and Jim for a while. I'm Jerry Pippin. Don't go away. You know, when we pause for a commercial, it's always for somebody who pays the freight, pays the way. Well, I'm going to take time out to talk about somebody who can't pay their way. And that's the stray animals, dogs and cats and other animals, who need your help. And there is a way to help them. Support no-kill animal shelters. It's a gift of life that keeps on giving. These animal shelters are located around the world and maybe in your neighborhood. Animals, they need love. They don't need to be sent someplace and then executed just because they don't have a home. Support the animal shelter that is a no-kill shelter near you. Give them a donation of $10, $25, $50 or more. The money will be well used. The animals will love you for it. So give a gift of love, a gift of life, to that stray dog or cat. Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin, and Jim Mars is on the line from Arlington, Texas, and his dinner's almost ready. So, Jim will be a nice host and not keep you too much longer, but we appreciate you hanging here for a little while.
Sure.
And we also have with us Grant Cameron. Grant is one of really the better researchers around, in my opinion. And we're talking basically about RAM. And I thought we would be really remiss if we didn't get somebody that was in on that group in the show. And Mark McCandlish is a well-known aerospace guy and interesting fellow. We've had him on a lot. One of the best shows we've ever done with you, Mark, was when you talked about going up to Dulce in the middle of the night, up on top of the Mesa.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. tell our audience a little bit about your background real quickly.
Well,
why you would be involved in this group even?
Well, I started out in the aerospace industry around 1980 and became interested in some of the more unique types of energy production. I was working at General Dynamics at the time. And began a correspondence with Tom Bearden, who gave me a basic primer on what are called quantum zero-point fluctuations of the vacuum, or zero-point energy. Back then, it was also being called by a number of other names, including scalar energy or cyclotronic energy. I think even as far back as Nikola Tesla's time, they were referring to this particular type of energy as longitudinal waves. So I spent a couple of years working at General Dynamics and then began freelancing throughout the aerospace industry as a conceptual artist and designer. Had a chance to work with all the major aerospace companies and began to see some technology that was obviously way beyond what the public believed we had a capability for producing and deploying. And as time went on, more and more information came into my hands. And then in 1988, a friend of mine let me in on some information indicating that apparently the military had recovered a number of crashed vehicles that had come from some other star system, and that Lockheed had been a major participant in back engineering the technology in the form of what was originally called the Alien Reproduction Vehicle, ARV, or it also had the nickname of the Flux Liner. Flux being
tell me why it has that nickname.
Well, the Flux Liner, the term flux actually is an electrical term. It comes from the meaning of an electrical potential or an electrical charge. And this particular vehicle does utilize some of those principles. It's primarily a system that's been developed to tap into these quantum zero-point fluctuations of the vacuum. And because of the way the system is structured, it's able to not only use a nearly limitless source of electrical power that's embedded in the fabric of space-time, but it's also able to reduce or completely demass itself so that accelerating up to and beyond the speed of light is actually a reality. And so, this kind of went against the grain for me. It went against everything that I was aware of in terms of what physics claimed was even possible. And so I began trying to find an explanation for why it could be possible. And I also began a correspondence with a number of other luminaries in the theoretical physics realm, including Tom Vallone and Hal Puthoff and a number of their colleagues, and was eventually able to figure out how the system worked. And so that's
okay,
pretty much...
Before you get out of here, Mark, we're going to talk about exactly how the system worked, but right now we're kind of doing an overview of the whole thing.
Right.
And, Jim, before you go eat dinner, feel free to jump in here with any comments. And, by the way, When did Gordon first come up the idea with you, Jim Mars, of making a movie? And do you think he ever really talked to Steven Spielberg?
I do not know that he actually got in touch with Steven Spielberg. I know he was wanting to.
He talked about that, too.
Yeah, as I said earlier, I don't think the idea for the film came up until he decided he wasn't making any headway trying to contact relevant people in government and in industry, and particularly the ones who he thought were in charge of the sequestering of UFO information. The only thing I'll add to what Mark just said is that, you know, this in a way ties into my new book, Our Occulted History, Things That Are Hidden From Us, and I deal mostly with anthropology and archaeology, but also in the realm of science. I know in researching for my book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, we were having problems developing the atomic bomb because using centrifuges to produce enriched uranium, U-235, was proving costly and time-consuming. The Nazis apparently came up with a whole alternative science by using a chemical process to refine uranium and to produce U-235. And so if that's true, there are alternative ways of doing things, you know, that do not fit with what we have been preconditioned by our schooling to accept as scientific dogma.
Yeah, Grant, I find this entire subject fascinating, and Jim just went off on another area that we really haven't discussed too much in this show, and that's a Nazi technology, and it keeps coming up over and over and over in discussions as late as a book on Area 51 a couple of years ago. So that was kind of laughable, but at the same time, they tried to sell that book with a straight face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't really watched too much research on the Nazi stuff. I did have a comment, however, on Mark. Mark's talking about this story back in 1988, and this kind of interests me. I can sort of give you a little bit of the timeline on this, because it's actually pretty interesting to go back to our friend at the CIA again. The incident that Mark's talking about occurred on November the 12th, 1988, at Norton Air Force Base. Correct, Mark?
Well, that's where it initiated. I was supposed to meet a friend of mine from college who had contacts with the Department of Defense and with Lockheed Martin. And the gentleman that we were going to be meeting with, and a number of other people, including the late Congressman Georgie Brown Jr., who was the head of the Congressional Committee on Space Science and Advanced Technology, along with Alan Cranston, were all at Norton Air Force Base, along with a number of high-ranking congressional representatives and military dignitaries. And they were all put on a military passenger jet, and they were flown up to Air Force Plant 42, in Palmdale, where Lockheed Skunk Works is located, and that is actually where the show took place. That's where they saw all these things.
Okay. That's of interest to me because I don't know if you know, like Aviation Week, just after that, Bill Scott wrote an article, and he talked about these well-choreographed show-and-tell sessions given to selected members of Congress and key government officials, and that they were doing this to garner further financial backing. What interested me was the timing of the November 12th thing, because there's a whole pile of stuff that happened within weeks of that event that seemed to tie in to this idea that maybe they had actually sort of allowed this thing to sort of leak out that they were doing this. And one of the things was, for example, 2 days before that incident with the flux liner, the demo of this thing flying around inside the hangar, was the Defense Department released the fact that they had the F-17A stealth fighter. A couple of weeks, 4 days before that event was the election. Reagan had left the White House and Bush had been elected. And I remember back, I was involved in UFOs pretty heavy back at the time, and I remember there was always the story that Reagan was involved and Reagan was going to do something. And I remember one of the more dramatic stories was that Reagan, at the end of his presidency, would appear on live TV and he would have the live alien with him. So we were anticipating something was going to happen. And there was a number of things that did happen. For example, this happens on November the 12th. If you go back about 3 or 4 weeks before that, you have what I call the biggest drop of information by the CIA into the UFO community. That was the UFO documentary, this two-hour documentary, UFO Cover-Up Live, where you had the Falcon in the audience, where you had the introduction of the Falcon and the Condor. All that happened about 3 or 4 weeks before that. And the day after that UFO Cover-Up Live, they had a meeting in the Office of the Counterintelligence at CIA, and involved in that meeting was Ronald Pendolfi, Git Green, Richard Weaver, who wrote the Roswell Report for the Clinton administration, and Hennessy, who controlled all the technology, the security for the technology on the black programs for the Air Force. They had a meeting talking about the UFO cover-up live, about Richard Doty playing the Falcon. And if you take that, and then you take after that, within days of this incident where the flux liner was flown, you have, well, probably meeting at the same time, Robert Lazar phones up Edward Teller, and within days he goes to EG&G and has the first of three interviews to go up to Area 51. That happened exactly the same month as this thing happened. So you take a look at all this stuff, and there's all sorts of sort of dropping things happening around this whole incident at Norton Air Force Base there.
Yeah, Jim, I'm going to let you go here in a minute, but because I know dinner's ready, but these things happen every once in a while, as Grant talking about. All of a sudden, there's a flood of information, then it kind of goes away. It's
Yeah, the one that sticks in my mind, it was in the about June or May of 2001, when Stephen Greer held a big news conference up in Washington. All the major media were there, and he had about 100 plus former military and government people who were all getting up and saying their experiences with the UFOs, and it looked like that might have been about to break a disclosure into the open. But then, despite all the major media being there, nothing really much was said about it except on the internet and the UFO community. And then it rocked along, and then all of a sudden there was a few pieces in the media, and it looked like they were beginning to pick up on it. And then we had 9/11, and that was the end of that. And, that's, you know, every time there's some kind of big, huge, earth-shaking event, if you look closely, it's usually to cover up something else that's going on.
This is true.
It's food for thought, and you just look at the history of all of this.
Yeah.
Not only just with UFOs, but almost any top secret operation that gets exposed.
Yeah.
As some other event comes along, have you ever noticed?
Yeah, absolutely. Somebody gets shot or something, you know, and it's always something to get our minds off of what's going on.
Okay, let's talk about your book for a minute. It's available now, and you have three possible things besides evolution and creationism. You have another alternative. Is that right, Jim?
Are you talking about within the same book?
Yeah.
Oh, well, actually what I've done in this book, and this is why I think it'll really be of interest to you, Jerry, because you cover both topics, is I have combined two topics that were heretofore thought not connected, and that is the one topic, which is hot right now, and a lot of people are onto it, the New World Order, or, you know, the 1%, or, you know, an Illuminati, whatever you want to call them, the idea that a handful of people are trying to run the world, largely through economics, okay? That's nothing new. And then there's a growing interest in this topic that's kind of an offshoot of the UFO issue, which is the idea of ancient astronauts or aliens in our distant past. And my hypothesis was, do the two connect? And I was somewhat surprised to find out that, yes, they do. Just to give you a titillating glimpse, we all know the Rothschilds, banking dynasty, is at the top of the pyramid of power in the world today. And I was kind of amazed to find out that some years ago, they even named one of the Rothschilds Nimrod, because they claim that they are the descendants of the Sumerian Anunnaki god king Nimrod, who claimed that he was born of an earth woman and a space father. So now the idea is, it doesn't matter whether we want to believe all that, okay? The point is, they do.
Yeah. Name of that book again?
Our Occulted History.
I like that title, even though it's not about what we call the occult.
Even no, but though it's the
you
astronomical
explained it
sense.
Earlier.
Yeah, it's the astronomical sense. It hides.
And then, of course, this is the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. Got a new version of Crossfire coming out. I'm sure you got some new information there.
Oh, yeah. It's going to pretty well tell the tale, I think. And that's due out probably in the early fall. I hate to bow out, but I don't want to incur the wrath of the cook.
I understand. I understand. So we're going to let you leave, sneak away from the discussion. Thanks very much, Jim, for taking time out to join us.
Let me just leave you with this. Gordon Novell was just, you know, he was I was trying to say a loose cannon, but he was worse than loose. He was rolling all over the deck. But I think at heart he meant well, and I think he was operating in the only way he knew how to operate as an entrepreneur. And I agree with you. I think his story probably needs to be told, and I would wish that people would take his whole experience, his whole life into account, and not just pick apart a few little tidbits where he may have exaggerated or may have been proven wrong about something.
Okay, now, Mark, thanks, Jim. Go to enjoy your dinner.
Y'all take care.
Okay, Mark McCandish, I know later on you became disenchanted with Gordon. And we might discuss that in a little bit, but let's get back to how you got involved with him to begin with and this entire group. Did he contact you or you contact him or what?
Well, there was an intermediary. At the time, I was, in November of 1988, I came into this information, and I began taking notes on all of the things that my friend had seen, began putting together a scale drawing of everything that he had told me, bit by bit, until I finally finished the drawing in March of 1989. And I sent a copy of this to Brad, who is the young fellow who had told me about this stuff, and I had made several blueprints of it. None of which had any call-outs of any kind. And I sent him a copy, and he called me up on the phone, and he says, you know, Mark, every detail that you've got on this drawing is right on the money. He says, you've scaled it right, relative positioning, the sizes, the relationship between the different components is right on the money. He says, in fact, he says, this probably has to be one of the most dangerous illustrations you've done in your whole career. And he says, if you're smart, you'll tear it up and throw it away, and you'll never talk about it again. Well, of course, I didn't do that, and I started getting threatening phone calls on the phone.
Who were these threatening phone calls from?
Well, they never said. It was just I'd be out visiting with a client in Los Angeles, where I was living in that area at the time. Regarding another illustration job, and my girlfriend would get a call at her home, and the voice would say, a male voice, you better tell your boyfriend to stop doing what he's doing or he's going to be very sorry. Things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Usually black vehicles with the windows blacked out following me. I would get a lot of interference on the phone line. I would call in to speak to somebody on the radio, and the line would be cut off. And the next thing that happened was the Internal Revenue Service started showing up and making allegations about not filing taxes properly, this kind of thing. And it just kind of escalated from there. They came and they seized my cars, seized my bank accounts. I mean, it really got nasty. And so I was getting pretty paranoid by the time that all of this stuff started to really surface. I felt that perhaps the only way I was going to survive was if I went public, and I did it incrementally. I first began calling radio talk shows in the Los Angeles and in the San Francisco Bay Area, superficially describing what I had become aware of, and was met with a lot of skepticism. And then I met a fellow who was a UFO researcher by the name of Paul Shepard. He was friends with the late actor Dennis Weaver and his son Rusty, who lived in Southern California, right across the state line from where Dulce, New Mexico was, and they had reported seeing an awful lot of UFO activity in that area and had communicated this to Paul Shepard. And so I began a correspondence and phone calls and things with Paul Shepard, who was also following the Billy Meyer case very closely at the time. He had a 900 phone number you could call into, and for so many pennies a minute, you could listen to his latest announcement about what was going on with Billy Myers, Semyasi, and the Pleiadians. And so eventually Paul and I met, and I gave him a copy of the blueprint, and he eventually told me in about July of 1989 that he knew someone in the aerospace industry who was very interested in the topic and was interested in commercially developing the technology, wanted to know if I'd like to meet with him. And I said, yeah, I'd love to do that, and as long as I don't get shot, you know, in the process. And so he was the one who introduced me to Gordon Novell and his friend, a physicist from Hercules Aerospace in Sandy, Utah, by the name of George Ulick. Gordon and I got along really well, and I eventually introduced him to Brad, and we took him over to Brad's office, which was in the Union Bank building in Pasadena, California, up on the, I think it was the third or the fourth floor. And he told the whole story to Gordon and to George, and it was about that time that Gordon suggested that I should probably label all the components in the blueprint and create call-outs that surrounded the image of the cutaway illustration, explaining what I thought each of the components was supposed to do. And so I did do that, and then I produced a number of copies of that. But at this point, there were, I think, a total of six copies of the blueprint that had no call-outs on it. And so Gordon and George and I had an agreement. Brad did not want to be involved at all because he realized that he was the leak and that he had certain liabilities as a result of that. So he wasn't a part of the agreement at all. And So the three of us, Gordon, George, and I, formed an agreement that if we were able to successfully develop any commercial application of this technology, that we would share equally in the proceeds from that endeavor. But it was basically a non-disclosure agreement as well. And so what I didn't know beyond that point was that Gordon was making copies of the blueprint and handing them out to just about anybody under the sun that he could. And what happened after that was that he wound up giving a copy of this blueprint to Frank Abeta-Marco, who was a production person involved with the Star Trek TV series, knew Gene Roddenberry and those kinds of people, and pretty much explained to him that the technology in the drawing was for real and that all the stuff that the Star Trek TV series was based on was actually a scientific fact. And so what happened from there was that Frank Abeta-Marco sent a copy of this blueprint to his brother, Fred Abeta-Marco, who is the editor-in-chief of Popular Science magazine. And they wound up publishing it in, I believe, February or March of 1994 in their first issue about Area 51. And it was a really small illustration, but as soon as that illustration and the article hit the newsstand, Gordon went through the ceiling and accused me of being responsible for the leak and began calling me and threatening me, and it just kind of got worse from there. So, at the time he was claiming that he was a CIA asset and that he had friends in high places and he couldn't wait to see how they were going to whack me, which was his way of saying shoot me or kill me or some way. So that was when my relationship with Gordon began to go south.
Yeah, I can understand that. Now, you at one time told me off the air and an email, I think, that that Gordon's idea on this vehicle wouldn't work, but you had an idea that did work. Is that right? So in other words,
correct.
What I'm asking you, if you have an answer to alternative energy here or what we're talking
sure.
about? Or
absolutely. Yeah.
Can you let our listeners in on a little bit of that?
Well, I can explain first why what he thought this theory of operation was for the system and why it wouldn't work, and then I can tell you what the difference was.
Okay, fine.
Gordon's idea was that you were going to charge up this array of capacitors around the bottom of the vehicle, which was kind of a colossal example of the Beefeld Brown effect, and that somehow was going to mass cancel the huge Tesla coil that operated within the structure of the vehicle. It was kind of like a Jell-O mold type UFO design. It had a little dome on the top, which was the top half of a ball-shaped crew compartment. And around the belt line of that crew compartment were the huge, in the smallest example, 12-foot diameter primary windings of a very, very large multi-million voltage Tesla coil. Down through the center of that sphere ran the central column, which had the secondary windings of the Tesla coil, and somehow this charging up these capacitor arrays was going to allow for demassing the entire system, which would allow you to send electrons through the windings of the Tesla coil in the same fashion as you might if you were using superconducting materials. Now, he believed that by doing so, you would be able to circulate the electrons around this set of coils at faster-than-light speed velocities. And that was the primary error in his design theory. And I'll get back to that in a second. But the idea was that he was going to take that energy, superluminal electron voltage, and drive a small electric motor. And this electric motor was then in turn going to be coupled to a very large high voltage generator, which would actually wind up producing more electrical power than it took to drive the motor. And all of this, at least by Gordon's theory, was going to be possible because all of the components were demassed by virtue of the Beefeld Brown effect. So let me go through this and explain why this wouldn't work. Number one, the Beefeld Brown effect by itself is a polarization process that occurs within the parallel plate capacitors, and there is a kind of levitation that occurs. You can see lifters on the internet that exhibit this kind of phenomenon. Most people agree that it's a kind of ion emission or an ion wind that actually is able to permit this to happen. Looks like I'm getting a call on my cell phone here. Stand by for just a second. I'll have to talk to you later.
Okay, we're talking about Mark McCandless here, and he's explaining how this works.
I'm back. Anyway, I'm sorry about that. It was an unexpected phone call. The premise that electrons can move through a conductor at superluminal speeds is flawed from the get-go, and the reason is that the thing that separates conductors from non-conducting materials is the fact that the outer electron shell of the atoms of materials like copper, silver, gold, these electron shells have a certain amount of instability in them, and that is to say that they can not only accept but give up additional electrons very easily, and that's the nature of why they're considered to be conducting materials. And so if you send an electrical impulse through a conductor, what's really happening is that electrical impulse is basically knocking the electrons from one atom out of the electron shell, and they're jumping to the next available electron shell. And so it's a cascading effect that goes down the line like a little steel ball bearings, one hitting the next and hitting the next and hitting the next. But each time that happens, the atom is really jumping from one orbit on one atom to an outside orbit on the next atom, and because of the instability created by, you know, the added company of this new electron, that electron or one of the electrons in that particular atom will then jump to the next adjoining member of this metal. And so that's how electricity passes through a conductor. Now, the actual impulse itself does not travel at the speed of light. It travels somewhere between 75 and 80% of the speed of light, but it's really just a ripple effect that moves through the capacitor, or excuse me, through the copper or the conductive material. And so the idea of being able to move electrons through a conductor, actually having them flow through a conductor at superluminal or faster than light speed, is impossible, just by the nature of what conductors do. Even when you find a superconducting situation, or if you're able to institute a superconducting situation, the drift velocity in a conducting material of an individual electron by itself, even with the impulses of electricity, even super high voltages traveling through the conductor, the drift velocity of a single electron is about 1 foot per hour. So the idea of electrons being able to flow through these big windings of a Tesla coil at faster than light speed, superluminal speed, is just impossible. And in fact, if you really think about it, if Gordon's idea held any water at all, just about every 12 or 15 foot winding at these huge generators we have at hydroelectric facilities all around the world would be levitating and floating around because they'd be demassing themselves, and that's just impossible. It's not happening. So the big flaw there was that premise. But the second flaw in Gordon's design was that if you then take this high voltage discharge coming from the capacitors and you use this energy to drive a small electrical motor, even if the electrical motor is demassed, the problem is that the amount of electricity that actually is required to make the rotor inside that motor turn is still governed by the amount of electromagnetic repulsion and attraction that occurs within the structure of the motor. So it requires a certain amount of energy to do that. So the idea that you can couple that shaft to a generator that then uses the same mechanism of pushing a magnet through an electromagnetic field to create current, you're still stuck with the same relative forces that have to be dealt with. And so the idea of taking a small motor, which is using electricity to create kinetic or mechanical action, it still has to work against the resistance of a larger set of magnets and a larger set of windings. So you wind up with an impasse at this point because you can't overcome the relatively same amount of electromagnetic stresses and shear forces that have to occur within the structure of a generator to create more electrical energy from that generator than it would take to drive the electrical motor that's pushing the whole idea.
Go ahead.
Well, even if the whole thing is demassed, it wouldn't work. And so the difference between what Gordon had developed, and he, believe it or not, actually got a patent on this idea, which still amazes me when I think about it. Now, and when you really look at Gordon's patent, I think what you find is that it doesn't really make any claims like driving a large generator with a small motor. It basically is a systems patent. It is a design for a system that he patented. It's not the actual claim of levitation. It's not the actual claim of overunity or free energy. It's just a system design patent is really all it is. And so that may be the only reason why the patent was given any consideration.
Now you think you have the solution, and this is radio. We don't have time to get into it completely.
Okay.
But I want to
give you the basic idea.
Yeah, okay.
I'll give you the basic idea. Now, if you've ever heard of something called ball lightning,
yes,
is a kind of plasma effect that occurs when a powerful lightning discharge from the sky hits quartz-bearing rock. It's something that they've actually been able to produce artificially in the laboratory. It was first discovered in the production and the operation of nuclear-powered submarines, where they had these massive blade-type switches that would be closed to take the electrical power that came from the generators that were driven by the heat exchangers and the steam turbines that were run by nuclear power. Basically, you're using an extremely high-powered heat source to create steam that pushes a turbine, that pushes a generator, and the generator then goes and drives electrical motors to turn the propellers that makes the submarine go forward. But when they would close these big blade-type switches to turn this whole thing on, sometimes they would get a discharge, and this discharge would look like a glowing ball of glowing plasma gas that would float down the aisles inside the submarine, and this phenomenon would persist for 30 seconds, sometimes as much as a minute. And so they began trying to duplicate this particular phenomenon in the laboratory, and they were successful. There's an acquaintance of mine, James Woodward, who's written extensively about it. He's been researching it for many years. And what they didn't know at the time was that this this persistence, this self-stabilizing, self-powering effect was not only tapping into the quantum zero-point fluctuations of the vacuum, which was part of where it was getting its energy and the way it was able to sustain itself, this phenomenon. But it was also producing something called X-ray photons, which are fairly lethal and can cause cancer. And so James wound up actually having a battle for his life as a consequence of his research, and I believe he's successfully fighting that battle right now. But so you have to understand there's a certain amount of danger involved. Well, the idea of being able to contain this particular phenomenon is probably what James, I think it's John, or is it Don Farrell and Jim Mars have been looking at in terms of the Nazi connection to UFOs. Now, Don Farrell had found some information that dated back to the end of the Third Reich. Some experiments that were being done on something called the Nazi Bell, which was an apparatus that was remarkably similar to the propulsion system for the alien reproduction vehicle. It involved a large set of circular coil, copper coil wires with a central column, very much like a Tesla coil. But in the center of all of that, inside of the secondary windings of this Tesla coil, was a large vertical chamber that encompassed two counter-rotating cylinders filled with a solution that had mercury, thorium, and beryllium peroxide. Now, there was a certain kind of quartz that was being employed in this device, and this was part of a mechanism that was designed by some of the leading German physicists who coincidentally happened to be Jewish and probably wound up being killed by their own experiments. But the idea was that they were trying to create a system for neutron bombardment. Now, if you look at mercury and you look at thorium, which was used as a what you'd call a an element that would reduce the threshold of emission, that's a physics term that I got from Hal Puthoff. Thorium sits right next to uranium on the periodic table. And so the idea was that if you can create an environment of neutron bombardment, you can actually transmute the thorium into weapons-grade uranium. And this is probably one of the prime reasons why the technology has remained classified for so long, because if anyone was able to duplicate the experiments that were done by the Germans in the attempt to create and develop nuclear weapons, every tin horn dictator around the world who wanted nuclear weapons might be trying to build a system like this. But the outcome of the initial reaction was a neutron blast that killed just about every living thing within 100 feet of the apparatus, including many of the scientists and a lot of the Nazi overseers. And it's part of the reason why the whole system was buried in the Winsalus mine, completely surrounded by lead tiles, But one of the things that they began to find as a consequence of the operation of the system is that it would begin to levitate. And so above the mine, there was an apparatus, a cement structure that looked remarkably like a completed version of Stonehenge, a series of columns in a circular array with a series of capstones that went from one column to the next in a circle. There were all kinds of heavy-duty power cables that led up to this particular structure, and it appeared as though it was being used as a means for powering an object and at the same time keeping it from floating away. So it's my belief that if there is any true and legitimate connection to the Nazi Bell program and the Hanabu program, the so-called Nazi UFO program, this may be part of it. But one of the other things that I believe happened was they began looking at everything on the roster in terms of scientific experimentation, including the work that was done by Victor Schauberger, who was very interested in vortices and energy forms that were duplicated, duplicating the processes that you would see in nature, like a whirlpool or like the little tornado of water that goes down the drain caused by the Coriolis effect when water draining out of your sink or your toilet. And what he found was that if you could force this kind of a vorticular motion in water and other kinds of liquids, that it would actually begin to glow a bluish green color, and it would produce an electrical discharge. And so when you combine that idea and the idea of circulating mercury, thorium, and beryllium peroxide in this column with two counter-rotating cylinders, and you look at the idea of using certain kinds of quartz in conjunction with this mechanism producing a neutron bombardment event, you can see that they were looking at ways to create not only weapons-grade material, but they were also looking at a phenomenon that was producing a prodigious amount of electricity. And as they began experimenting with this, I think what happened was they realized that there might be alternative ways in which to tap into the energy that was apparently being produced in the center of this device where the two counter-rotating columns were. And so as I was looking at all of these stories and the information and various eyewitness accounts from not only the aerospace industry, but from ufology itself, I thought that it might be a good idea. I was somewhat skeptical of the whole alien abduction phenomenon, but what I decided to do was contact some of the people who were claiming that they'd been abducted by aliens with the intention of telling them that I worked as a conceptual designer and illustrator in the aerospace industry, and that if they had seen any kind of components in an engine room or a propulsion system component of any kind, if they could simply describe it for me, that there might be some way to ascertain what those components were. I mean, even if you're a Native American and you've never seen a car and you look at a V8 engine and then you see another one similar to it, you can still assume that by the shape of the device that it performs a similar function. And this is really the approach that I was taking. So what I did was I asked a number of these individuals who claimed that they had had this abduction experience if they had ever been hypnotically regressed, if they'd ever described any kind of propulsion system components. And to my complete and utter surprise, there were at least two people who could describe components. And this was before I had ever publicly unveiled any of the information about the alien reproduction vehicle.
Yeah,
this was in late.
Mark, we're almost out of time.
Okay.
Clock has got us, but basically, to make a long story short here, you feel that it is possible to develop this alternative energy,
yes,
and it's probably been done.
Yes, it has.
There's no doubt about it in your mind.
No, I don't think there is. And, you know, the eyewitness accounts that I have from the aerospace industry alone confirm for me that not only has Lockheed been involved in the production of this kind of technology, but I'm pretty sure that Boeing and probably McDonnell Douglas have as well. There have been sightings near their top-secret development facilities, the Phantom Works, Boeing's special facility up near Puget Sound, a lot of UFO sightings. And, many sightings near Edwards Air Force Base and China Lake Naval Weapons Station north of there, out in the middle of the desert. And of course, there's the stories about Area 51. But I think the idea is that if you can tap into this zero-point energy and you can essentially reduce the mass of the apparatus or the vehicle that's employing the technology, you can accelerate the device to what are called arbitrarily high speeds, basically meaning faster speed of light. But the same technology, when used in a lower power output, would be able to produce a tremendous amount of electrical power. The drawback is, of course, that it uses a tremendous volume of mercury, which is highly toxic. And, of course, if the mechanism becomes damaged, or if the shielding around it becomes damaged, you have the prospect of neutron bombardment, which, of course, is lethal.
Okay, Greg.
So it's the kind of technology that would have to be used in a power plant rather than in the average home, you know.
Yeah, Greg Cameron, are you still there?
Yeah, I am.
So we had a little science lesson here on why this is possible and why we think that this sort of alternative energy is available.
Yeah, I'd like to ask Mark, is this what they were using at the Lockheed demonstration in 88?
It was one of the early systems. The system that that was seen in 1988 was witnessed by a mutual friend of Bill Scott, the editor of Aviation Week, and my own, as a fellow that I met at an air show at Edwards Air Force Base, who had actually, in 1973, had seen one of these alien reproduction vehicles at Edwards North Base, and wound up being brought into the fold, so to speak, after his unpredicted sighting of this technology in a hangar at Edwards North Base. Is a kind of a story behind that, too. But the idea is that it took them probably 20 years or so to figure out how this technology worked after the recovery at Roswell, New Mexico.
We're out of time, guys. I'm really sorry.
Okay.
But the time has got us. Basically, to make a long story short to both of you, this technology exists. Neither one of you have a doubt about it.
No doubt.
No. Okay. Thanks very much, both of you. This wraps up our show on free or low-cost energy and back engineering of UFOs. If you have any comments, we'd like to hear from you at jerry@jerrypippin.com. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next week. Until then, cheers.